This is Jody Stone on the 10th of February, 1987, interviewing Lila Senior Nash at her home on Bostwick Hill in Lakeville. Lila, when were you born?
I was born December 7th, 1903, up in Salisbury.
How about your parents?
Right,
were they born here?
No, right across from, I was born up there in Salisbury, right across from the main Whitfield's drugstore on the other side. There was a little cottage there where we lived, and my mother's name was Mary Knickerbocker, and my father's name was Ernest Senior, and my mother was the New York State Dutch, and my father was English. My father worked, and my grandfather, his father, worked in the Holly Manufacturing Company as with the knives.
So he was one of the ones who came from England?
The one was England, my grandfather. Mm-hmm. But my father was born in Beacon Falls, Connecticut. But my grandfather, who came from England to work in the with the Holly knives. Mm-hmm. You know, the English people were cutlers and shapers and all that kind of, they did all that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. And what's in Salisbury now where your cottage was, where you were born? What's there now?
That's gone now. I think there's a cottage across from the drugstore. That was, on that side, but that's gone now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And stores and other things have been put in there,
yeah.
You know. And I remember my parents lived there the year of the Great Fire.
What was that?
Well, they had on the opposite side. The Great Fire was in April 1903, and of course I was born in December, but my mother said that the fire was so hot and so great that the window panes across mm-hmm. the road were hot, and the fire, they said, started in a tailor's shop, mm-hmm. and it took everything from St. John's Church down to the Academy.
Now, your mother, you told me your mother was a school teacher?
Yeah,
she
taught school. She was the last teacher up on the mountain.
Where was the school?
The school was up there. The mountain came into being in 1781. That's when the mountain arrived. And they had the first ball forge erected up there. Of course, this was the year of the... when the iron industry started, and they had a thriving village came up there, and they had all the stores and a post office and mm. schools and department stores, and it was a real village up there, a real thriving village for over 100 years.
Was this the Lower Lake?
This was down on the, what they called, the North Pond.
Yes, where the dam is, the new dam.
Yeah, down through there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was pretty rugged country all up there, and it was just great. The nature up there was something to see with the flowers and all that. But then when the iron industry, our iron mining came in to being, well, then there's all these people came in to work up there.
From where?
Nobody seems to know. They came over from the Millerton, New York side. There was a road up that way, and then they came out over from the Massachusetts side, from Mount Washington, and then they imported a lot of these people from to work the mines and the charcoal pits. And you know, this was a rugged job, mm. and I suppose that they were all looking for the work. And some of them came in from Russia, Latvia,
mm.
and the Swiss people came in too. But it's funny. There's no foreign names up on the mountain in the cemetery, in the original cemetery. They're all Salisbury names. So where these people went, we don't know, after the mines closed and the iron ore was industry was discontinued.
Which was when? When did it finally end?
Well, it started in the mountain. It was started in 1781 with the first forge erected. It was called the Ball Forge. And of course, the iron industry was the big industry in during that time because of the Revolutionary War. And it went for over 100 years. And I think, and I got a little thing here, a book that I had written. And in 1863, Alexander Lyman Holly, who was a young engineer and inventor, and he was son of the governor Holly, and he put his put the rang the death knell for the local iron industry with his Bessemer steel process. So that's when it was sort of petered out at that time. That's what happened, why it was no longer mining and industry here. It was, we were put out of business by one of our own.
Tell me, you know the term raggy?
Well,
some people say it nastily.
It's what?
In a nasty tone of voice. Oh, he's a raggy, or oh,
yes,
those raggy.
Yes, this is, well, this started back in 1781 when all these workmen came in, because some of them were very rough and very tough. And they were, I've seen pictures of some of them, and they really were something to look at. But that's when the raggy name started. But as the years went by, and the descendants and everything came down and into the valley, and then the raggy name became a privileged name, because people looked at the raggy name as not very dignified. I mean, it to give you an idea of what these people were like. And sometimes they called them the unwashed and unkept. So, and some historians say that they only washed when it rained, and but there was plenty of water up there. But that the descendants of the raggies were, as the years went by, they got better and better people, and the people that lived up there were not only the that worked in the iron industry. There were farmers up there too. But one lady told me that, one old lady told me that by word of mouth we get the history, you see, and tell you what happened up there. And she said she used to watch the workmen go down in the morning, and she said there were at least 1,000 or more.
Really?
Yeah, well, they would have to be, because there were the charcoal burners, and then there were the woodcutters. And that's why they had the furnace up there, because where the wood was, it was easier to take the iron ore up to the wood and cut it down for the charcoal burners than it was to bring the wood down to the below. So this is what she said. And they were rough looking at first, and then of course, they would have to be, because you wouldn't find any refined lawyers or businessmen working in the iron industry. So this is why they were called raggies. And it's funny, every time you'd go anywhere out of town, into Hartford, anything, they ask people, where do you live? And they would say Salisbury, and they'd say, oh, you're a raggie.
It was that well known.
It was that well known, and Salisbury was the Raggies' home, and that's how it got its name. And it's kind of too bad, but now it's a privilege to be called a Raggie, because there are very few of them left.
But there are some people still living, as I would put it, on the way up.
Well, the people that I could give you, I've written down some of the names that were on the mountain at that time that were living up there, that were the mountain people. And let's see, there were some people with the name of Flint and Holder and Bontel, B-O-N-H-O-T-E-L.
They're still here.
They're still here, yeah. Right. And Surdam, S-U-R-D-A-M, and Thurston, and Brazy, and Rossiters. The Rossiters lived up there. The Rossiters were the last people to come down off the mountain.
Were they?
And
which would have been when, Lila?
Well, that would be, they started coming down about 1890, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But then there were farmers up there. They still had farms, and they farmed quite a bit, and they all lived off the land in those days. And my mother said that when she was the last teacher there, in about, I think it was around just before 1890, and they closed the school because the teacher and the kids all got the measles, and it was never reopened. And so she said that while she was up there, that she had about 30 students. But when back in the earlier time, around the 1781s, when it first started, there were 70 students in that one new schoolhouse.
But did she live up there while she was teaching? Or?
No, she didn't. They lived down the valley. And she used to, her father, Richard Knickerbocker, my grandfather, used to drive her up Sunday nights. And she'd stay during the week, and then he'd go up after her with the horse and wagon or sleigh, whatever it was, and bring her back Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So she was home. And during the week, Samuel Rossiter, who was a farmer up there, used to board the teachers during the week.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how, she didn't tell me how much money she earned or how much, but also, all they taught up there was about reading and writing. And some arithmetic, maybe multiplications or additions or something. And then she told me about the time that then the children used to go out and eat their lunch on the north side of the school, and where it was sunny. And then they would eat their lunch there. And of course, they were bound to drop food and everything on the ground. And so she told me about the time they looked out and saw a wildcat out there picking up the crumbs. And one of the boys, I think his name was McLean, M-C, capital A-L-A-I-N, went out the back window and went home and got a gun and came back and shot the wildcat. And it weighed 80 pounds. It was the biggest one they'd ever seen.
That's like Chuck McLean, same name.
Yes, that's right. You can see that there are a lot of descendants around. And then, of course, they used to be, the children came to school. They had a lot of superstitions, you know, and they had their home remedies.
What were the superstitions?
Well, they would have a lot of superstitions about what happened. And some people up there, I told her I thought they were full of moonshine. They saw angels up there on the hills and a wailing rock where a young boy was crying and wailing after he'd been killed by falling off a cliff. And then some of their home remedies, she said some of the children used to come to school with camphor bags around their neck.
What for?
That was supposed to chase away the germs, I suppose, so they wouldn't catch anything. The camphor bags. And then she said some of them they used to use mustard plasters for congested lungs or things like that for pneumonia and different remedies, home remedies that they use. And so that's about all she told me about the children, and she said the children were just as, of course it was a rugged country, there was wildcats and snakes and bears once in a while, and they had to be alerted to all this danger, and she said the children were just about as, were trained to do this, to take care of themselves. And there was a Bontel boy, a little Bontel boy that lived up there, the Bontel family. And I think it was in 1889, they had the first Memorial Day parade, and he got lost. He wandered away from his home, and he was only 2.5 years old. And he was gone, he was lost for 77 hours. And they had a big manhunt up there, about 200 people or more were trying to find him. And of course they were worried about him, because in a rugged country like that, you could run up against a lot of animals and things. And Samuel Roster found him.
Alive?
Yep, he heard this, he was around with his horse and wagon going around the different places up there, and he got down into the, across a water, a river bank or some kind of pond or something, which wasn't very big, and so he drove in and together over on the other side, and in this, and he saw the bushes moving, and out stepped this little boy. And Mr. Roster said that all the money in the world wouldn't be, wouldn't want all the money in the world for that moment. He wouldn't take it when he saw the boy. And of course he was kind of scratched, and he'd probably been eating berries and things like that. But Mr. Roster said it was a great thrill to see that child after all those hours in that rugged mountain. And Amos, his name was Amos Bontell, and I knew him very well. He lived to be an old man, about 80 years old, and he worked for a plumber in Salisbury, and he died in a nursing home in Torrington.
That's fascinating. You know, that's a long trip up there by car. Well, it's not long, but it's a rugged trip by car on that road. You
well,
wonder.
They, of course, in the early days there, when the mountain was thriving, there were three ways over there that you could come up on the Millerton, New York side. And then there was the middle road up here in Salisbury, which was discontinued. And then there was the regular mountain road. And then there was the road over from Mount Washington.
Where's that middle road? Where did that
The
go?
Middle road is up near, is up beyond Lincoln City.
Oh.
And the middle road, that was, they don't use that anymore, but they did have to use it in about, and I think in the 1940s, we had a fierce mountain fire up there.
I've heard about that. Yeah. If you went up Lincoln City, straight up,
this, well,
you could keep going?
And keep going.
No turn left or right then.
No, there was
going.
A middle road.
Yeah.
But they discontinued it, and they went up that road when they had that fire because they had to get up there, and I remember the fire was really, it was really bad, and all the people went up, and some of them had jeeps and went up with brooms and all kinds of equipment to fight it. It was a fierce mountain fire.
What started it? Lightning?
Well, they didn't seem to know how it got started. It could have been man, and it could have been campers up there.
And of course, they were the camps, as we call them, were up there then. Did they all go?
No, they didn't.
That's
no,
amazing.
And I don't think any. I don't remember what any of the camps or buildings up there, what were up there, were burned. But anyway, it was the mountains and the trees and all this stuff that grow up there. It was fire. And of course, it was this brush and everything that was burning, but they got it under control, and it came down what was then called Factory Street quite a ways down.
It did?
Yes. And they were worried that it would get down, come down, let's see, it's called Washington Street now.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I never knew why it was changed from Factory Street to Washington Street. Because that's where all the factories were up there because of the water power on that Marquesimut Brook.
When did it change to Washington?
Well, it was changed to Washington Street, but I found out why. I was checking on what the factories were up there, and they had a Washington woolen mill.
Was this in the early 1900s they changed it?
Yes. Yeah. So I found out that I never knew why they changed it to Washington Street, because but then later on, I found where they had among the factories was the Washington woolen mill. That was it.
There's not much left except the Warner. Remember, which Warner was it? Did Salisbury Artisans.
The what?
Which Warner ran Salisbury Artisans? Remember they
made the... Oh, Philip Warner.
Yeah.
Philip Warner. And Philip Warner was quite a character, and he was very compassionate, and he didn't like to see people go without. They were kind of poor people. And Phil would never wear an overcoat because the other folks up
really?
That street couldn't wear one.
That's nice.
Yeah, he was a nice fella. And then there was a, up on the mountain, there was, they had, there was a story about this lady and the snake.
What?
And the lady, you know, they used to wear these long, big black skirts and a cape or big hat because they were always picking huckleberries and bringing them down to sell. And one day she was out and she had been picking huckleberries, and the big rattlesnake came up behind her and struck out at her, and she didn't know what had happened. So she started to run, and she was so frightened she kept running and running. And she ran over all these, the rough rocks and everything. And finally she ran so much, so far that she was tired out, and she fell down. And she looked around, and the rattlesnake was in back of her and was dead. It had hit, when it struck, it had hit her black skirt, and the fangs went in the black skirt. And when she ran, she killed the rattlesnake over the rocks and things. So that's the lady
a
and the snake.
Story.
And then they had a, there was a rainbow tree up there, what they called the rainbow tree. And the Raggies hanged a Tory on the rainbow tree out over the gully. So these are all the stories that I remember. And then there was an old farmer that was down where the... Shagroy Market, that all that down that field is now, and all those houses, that he had a farm there. His name was Bert Clark, and he used to hire some of those mountain people, and they were good farmers. And he told about this farmer that found a sheep killed, been killed, and so the farmer wondered what killed it, and so he took the rest of what the sheep and poisoned it. And then he went up a little later to see why, what would happen. And he found an eagle and a skunk and a wildcat dead up there. They had eaten the rest of the sheep that he poisoned. And he said that eagles used to kill sheep in those days, which is something new to me.
Wow.
So this is the mountain. So there are a lot of stories that go on up there, and there are a lot of people, and there are people, a race and a breed of people that you'll never see again, mm-hmm. I'm sure. And Salisbury was always. I remember we used to have a basketball team, and used to play a team from Winston called the Goldenrods. And we'd hire a special train to take us to Winston, and we'd get up there, and another girl and I was, all these people were yelling at us, you Raggies. So anybody that came from Salisbury was definitely a Raggie. But now it's... a privilege to be called that, because the people have changed, they would mm-hmm. over the years.
Now, who was Calvin Sr.? Was he related?
Calvin Sr., no, he was not related, although he tried to make believe he was. But Calvin was not related to me. He was his father was George Sr., who was a carpenter, and who worked on early houses around. No, Calvin was not related. He had, his mother's name was Brazy, Emma Brazy. and they were definitely pinpointed as Raggies too. And he had a sister named Mary Senior, but they were not related to me, you know, because the seniors were from England, and as I say, George Senior, I guess, was a native here.
But you could be a native and not a Raggie.
Oh, you could be if you're a native, yeah. You're a Raggie. Definitely.
No.
Definitely. You have to be a native to be a Raggie. And so that's about all the stories I know about the mountain. And
let me ask you about the iron. It weighed so much.
Huh?
The iron ore weighed so much. How did they get it up to the... they did wagons, or did they have...
They didn't have a train, did they? Oh, they took iron ore. It wasn't melted, smelted into iron then. It was the iron ore from Ore Hill.
And they took it by wagon?
By wagon. Dragged it up to the top of the mountain to be forged.
Oh, that trip up there must have been terrible in the winter.
I don't think it was, because the traveling, the roads were a little different then. They didn't have cars to go up with it. So, I mean, you can get over a lot of road with wagons and mules. And they used to make frogs up there. I've got one up there on the mantle.
Oh,
if you lift that up, you can see how. All right.
Tell me about the anchors.
Oh, the anchors were forged up there on the mountain, and the Navy brass used to come up to test them.
How?
Before they bought them, and they take them up on the anchors. They take them up on the highest point of the mountain and drop them on the rocks below, and if they stood up, then they were tested and were sold to the Navy.
Navy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, of course, the cannonballs were made down in Lakeville, that furnace. And so actually, we were the arsenal of the Revolution.
And the chain?
And the chain across the
West
Hudson
Point?
River was, some of that was iron, our iron. And then, of course, after the Revolution and the Civil War, we came into the Civil War, mm-hmm. and when Lincoln sent out a call for volunteers, the mountain people were the first here to come down and enlist, and they enlisted in what they called the Iron Guard, and they called it the Iron Guard, and we had the Iron Guard flag up in the town hall, you know, that was carried and to the Civil War. And when the town hall was on fire, they rescued
it. I was going to ask you, did they
got
save
it out, which I was very pleased. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. and then they came down, and they were farming up there then at the time of the Civil War on the mountain. And so they came down and enlisted. And went to Civil War. When they came home from the Civil War, they couldn't pay their taxes, and so the town had to foreclose. And this is where the Riga Corporation comes into being.
Of course.
Yeah, and they bought up, I think Judge Warner was the one who bought the property that was put up by the town at auction, and this is how the Mount Riga Corporation came into being.
Right after the Civil War.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were then they moved down into the village and started to come down into the valley to work. They couldn't get to find work, and one of them was named Charlie Ball, and he was he was a descendant of the Ball furnace on the mountain, and Charlie was a little short fellow, and not very big, but he enlisted, and he lied his age, he and his cousin, and they got in to the war, and then they had that typhoid. He caught typhoid or something, and he was hospitalized down in Washington, and then he was going to be mustered out. So he stood in line and to get his papers and processed, and as he stood in line, a great big bully came and pushed him out of line. And Charlie had to go to the back of the line. And just as that bully did that, Abraham Lincoln came along and saw it. And he went down and he took Charlie by the hand and led him up to the head of the line and had his papers transferred. And then, while Charlie was fighting, he got away from his company on the battlefield. And General Grant came along in the gig and took him back to his company. So Charlie always said that he didn't think that any other Civil War veteran was ever favored by two presidents of the United States. And but when Charlie came back, he was he fished and sold fish, and then he was a rag picker, and.
What's that mean? What's rag picker?
They used to go around and pick up rags and sell them.
From houses?
Yeah, pick up different rags and sell them. You'd have a lot of old rags that you wanted to get rid of, and this is the way you'd get rid of it, because there was no transfer station in those days. Actually, I think the modern technology would frighten some of those people up there, because they never had any conveniences. They used to wash in these great big wooden tubs with a washboard. And so I can remember them doing that. And and then the schoolhouse was burned this last, let's see, 1956, last year, burned down. It had been remodeled, and I think a gas range was put in, and a heater, and all this, and that one, and it burned up. And I said the ghosts of the past just resented the modern technology. And so I wonder, you know, that's a part of a superstition. That's a superstition that the people on the mountain had. But that's when I said, well, I said, they had something to do with that, I'm sure.
Now, Charlie Ball was buried here. He did.
Oh yes, and he and his cousin, Hodball, they ran away and enlisted in the army and lied their age. And he had Charlie Ball married a younger woman. Ethel Van Dyke, her name was, and they lived up on the mountain road for quite a while, and then moved down, and they had, some children. Now there was Charles and Lyman and Harvey and Maud, the daughter, and Charles and Lyman and Harvey all were in the service, joined the army. They were all very much all of them in the service of the army, and there's just one, and Maud Ball, the sister, she was a graduate of Gilbert School, and she went down to Washington and got a job in the Pentagon. She was a very fast typist, and then, and of course the other three were in the service, and this was their aim in life, to serve the country. And there's just and Charlie Ball, who was the last one to leave here, lived up in the old house up on Factory Street, and he sold it to the Whitbecks. And he's down in Florida now. And all the others, Harvey and Maud and are gone. I don't know where Lyman is. He was the youngest, and he worked up in Vermont somewhere in the town. And the last I heard of him, and Charlie Ball is down in Florida. And we used to get letters and cards from him once in a while, but we haven't heard from him since. But they were a family of army people.
Now, Dave Brzee used to be the dog catcher.
Huh?
Dave Brzee used to be the dog catcher, right?
Dave was the dog catcher.
Yeah.
Yes, right. He was the dog warden, more or less.
Yeah.
And also, he was the mountain guide.
Yes.
And he knows a lot about the mountain, too. And I guess recently, he had some poems in the journal about the old man of the mountain.
Yeah.
And I know that they used to have a lot of these animals. And then I must tell you about how we almost lost our mountain in 1955 because they wanted to have a tri-state park up there. And my husband was a representative to the legislature at that time. It was in 1955. And Edwin Pobola was the other representative. You remember Edwin? And they were in there, and they got wind of what was going on. And so they led the attack against the defeat of this passing through the legislature. And I know my husband was able to get round up a lot of the legislatures to support it, and they defeated it. And a lot of the people from here went into the hearing, and we think what that would have meant to Salisbury, the traffic in this up the mountain roads. But they defeated it. I don't know. They were going to have a tri-state park up there of Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New York.
And were they going to try to buy land from the Roger Corporation?
They were going to buy land from somewhere. I don't know. Yes, they were. And they wanted to, but as I say, it had to go through the legislature before they could do this. And I know that my husband got wind of it, and he went to work against it. And a lot of the people went in, and even David Brazy was going to take in a little deer fawn and march it up the Capitol steps to show the protest. But anyway, it was defeated and it didn't go through, thank goodness. But look what it would have meant to the town of Salisbury with the traffic. And I think there was one person from here that got up and spoke against it. And it was John Percy, who was proprietor of the Interlaken Inn at the time. And he thought it would bring business to the town.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But all the rest were against it. So we won that, but it would mean an awful lot of traffic through this village and the publicity.
We were going to talk about Oogie Hoysrott's father, who was a pistol, I guess.
Well, he was named Clayton Heiser, and he was quite a fella. And we used to call him Tarzan because he had this long beard, and he used to swing on these swing things up in Roaring Oaks, where you could swing from one place to another on them.
Kind of like grapevines?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And they had, of course, they had, let's see, they had, I can't remember them, but all Mamie's children was in my Sunday school. And there was Donnie, and there was Oogie, who was Lester, and then there was three or four girls. And Meanie sort of brought these children up, and she was left. Of course, she died, and she was left with these children, and she did a good job of bringing them up. But the father was when he was living, she was married. She supported him also.
How do you spell Meanie?
Well, her name was Wilhelmina, uh-huh. Wilhelmina.
Oh, it was Mina for Mina. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, God. No, what about the Funk brothers?
Well, they lived up beyond the mountain road, and their house was divided. The line went through it. Each owned half of it, and half of the house. And they, one lived on one side, one on the other. And they didn't just speak or anything. And they used to come down the Undermountain Road, and the people said that they could set the clocks by the Funk Brothers coming down.
They came together, but they didn't speak?
No, they didn't speak. And they used to come down, and they'd come down, one would come down the same time every morning so that the people could set their clocks by him. And then there was Jakey Holder. I don't know whether you ever knew him. He was born upon the mountain, and he turned out to be a regular bum. And I used to see him around. He used to come in and sit on the town hall steps, and he was called the song and dance man. And he used to meet you, and he'd want to he'd make up a song or something for 10 cents to buy some wine. And he had, one of his songs were, Millerton has the big feet, Oriole has the rose, Oriole has the lily, Lakeville has the rose, and Salisbury has the drunken man, as everybody knows. And then he used to say, I was born upon Ryvie of honest and decent parents, as you all know, and I got a roaming. Then I got a roaming and a drinking at the age of 23, and the judge, he took my honor and sent me down for 30 days in old Litchfield Town. this is what he used to make up these things as he went along, but it was funny. And but he died. He lived through that first flu epidemic. And he slept out in the cold and barns wherever he could, but he never got the flu. He went through that epidemic without getting it. And so I don't know what happened. His real name was Clarence Holder, and his family lived up on the mountain, and they were really great, nice people. And but he, and he used to sit around on the town hall steps, in the old town hall steps. And he was always around, and sometimes he used to be in the horse sheds up there when they had the horse sheds. He'd sleep there or anywhere he could get in. And and then sometimes the janitor at the town hall would leave a little window open where the coal bin was, and Jakey would come in that window and spend the night.
Lila, the town hall. I don't remember this, so I guess it wasn't here when I came. But somebody told me at one point there was a jail to one side of it.
Well, that's right. The jail, that's really right. And Jakey lived in that jail for a while. So that, well, it was up by the cemetery.
Oh.
You go up in between the village store and the cemetery, and it was up there next to the cemetery. It was a jail.
Separate building from the town hall?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. It was a little brick jail. And that's where they used to round up the people and lock them up for a while. And then, of course, then that was discontinued. And then, finally, they decided they'd let Jakey go in and live there. And I had the story of him, and I have the pictures of him standing outside in the jail door with an apron on and a broom. And he lived there for quite a while. And then the property next door was bought by a Mrs. Haven, and that included the jail. So when she bought the property, she tore the jail down, which was unfortunate because it was a landmine. And then, of course, he had to get out. But I guess she did that to get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
But the town let him live there for a while. It was a nice, good place for him because they weren't using it.
Okay.
This was a character, and I had his picture up in the town clerk's office, and that went up in the smoke when it fired, the fire. And he was a character, and he had a modern haircut, and he was a very strong-looking face, but his name was Moses, Datus, D-A-T-U-S, Ensign, E-N-S-I-G-N, Titus, T-I-T-U-S. And he was the son of his father was a collier. And there were 14 children in the family. And Moses was slightly foolish. And he was a bother, a nuisance in the town. And the children used to yell at him, "Moses, Titus comes out of the wood to bite us," and yell at him and keep the place that was kind of so they wanted to get rid of him. So they bought him a one-way ticket to Philadelphia, and he walked back, and he died on the town farm here.
How old is he?
Well, he was quite old, and he was one of 14 children that his father had.
He walked back.
And he walked back, and he died on the town farm, and that's on record at the town hall. His death certificate is up there. And they used to, and then the Barnum boys, Lime Rock, took him one time and dressed him up in a Civil War uniform and sent him by express to Chicago. And they just sent him back. So that was that.
Well,